the world of wine is so big now. There's so much interesting stuff out there. And you don't want to, I mean, I always make a comparison to food in this case. I mean, you would never, if someone said, okay, you can only eat chicken and carrots for the rest of your life, even if you love chicken and carrots, it would be unthinkable in food, right? You would be like, no, I'm not going to just eat chicken and carrots my whole life. But a lot of people drink very narrowly their whole lives. And so they're missing out on all the mangoes, all the, I don't know, all the salads, all the pork chops, all the other things in life. So if you eat broadly with food, and most people do, then your drinking should be similar.
So I wanted to kick off this week's episode with a shout out to two of our loyal and enthusiastic listeners, and that's Lisa T in California and Joey V in Florida. Thank you both so much for your support of the podcast, for sharing, for letting me know your feedback and your excitement. It really means the world to me. So I'm sort of still beside myself with what I'm about to tee up here. Karen McNeil is a very well-known author, journalist, TV personality, instructor, mentor in the world of wine. And when I started this podcast and made a list of everyone that I would want to have on as a guest one day, she was at the top of the list. I mustered up the courage to reach out to her, and she said yes. Karen and I first met back in 2012. I was a student of hers in the wine program at the Culinary Institute of America, a wine program that she created and developed. And she is also the author of The Wine Bible, which in my opinion, and you guys have heard me talk about this book before, is the best wine reference book out there. It has sold close to a million copies worldwide. She also has been a winner of the James Beard Award for Wine and Spirits Professional of the Year. She's won an Emmy for her TV show on PBS called Wine, Food, and Friends with Karen McNeil. She's had a Barbie crafted after her. You'll have to listen in to hear more about that. And one that I find just really inspiring is that Karen was selected by the Napa County Historical Society as the only writer in their Napa's Pioneering Women exhibit, which is called Two Centuries of Women Who Have Changed Napa's Cultural Landscape. So honored to be introducing you to my interview with Karen McNeil, still digesting all of the things that we talked about, but you'll hear us touch on one of my favorite topics, the emotional power of wine, and why people like me can be brought to tears by something that's in the glass. We'll get her take on the topic of why does wine matter, something that I did an episode a few weeks back all about. And we'll also hear how she entered into the world of wine as what she calls herself an outsider, someone who didn't come from a wine family or a wine place, and who was a woman in an industry that back then really had little to no female representation. You'll hear we just get right into it, sipping a beautiful sparkling wine. We both poured it in our glass at the start of the interview, so we'll kick it off there and see what else ensues. I cannot believe I'm saying this, but here we go with Karen McNeil.
I have a glass of something with bubbles in it every night of my life. I'm almost religious about it. I feel like, you know, I don't spend a lot of money on clothes or on cars or on whatever you could spend money on. But champagne and sparkling wine, that's my one indulgence. And it's not even really an indulgence. There are so many great wines with bubbles in them, including champagne, that come out to being about $8 or $9 a glass. And I think, you know, I can do that every night, even on a more or less journalist salary. So over the years, this is all by way of saying that I taste a lot of sparkling wine and champagne. And of course, I have tons and tons of flutes, as anyone who loves this category of wine as much as I do, would have maybe. But I began to see many years ago that, you know, when you hand someone a glass, let's say in particular of champagne in a flute, you know, people look sexy, they stand up taller. It's just, it so feels so sleek and so good. And the bubbles are great, right? Because you've got this long linear glass, but you can't swirl the glass. And if you can't swirl, it means you can't really smell the wine very well. And if you can't smell the wine really well, then you probably aren't tasting it fully. So over time, I've come to the realization that, of course, all sparkling wines are wines first. They just happen to have bubbles in them. But you need to be able to swirl them and you need to be able to smell them. So the glass that I'm using is a very wide tulip glass. This glass in particular is one of the three glasses that are part of my own line of glassware called the Flavor First Collection, which is sold at Macy's and Amazon. And there are just three glasses in the collection. This glass, which is called the Crisp and Fresh glass, is used for all sparkling wines, champagnes, Prosecco, Cava, all rosés, Sauvignon Blancs, Riesling, any wine that is crisp and fresh. So thank you for asking.
You of all people, I don't have to ask you the question, does glassware matter? I think we're beyond that with your history in glassware. But as I mentioned in our sort of pre-communication, my listeners to this podcast are not wine nerds like me, necessarily people that study or even in the industry. My audience that I've built over the last 6 months of doing this is people that like wine. And so I get a lot of questions from listeners just about things that we would say are fairly elementary but important about glassware and aerating and decanting. So that's what I love to teach them and share with them. So that was just a great introduction right there. So thank you.
I don't think there are any elementary kinds of questions. I mean, wine is idiosyncratic. It's kind of complex. It doesn't always logically follow. And so you really have to ask whole bunches of questions before you really get to the heart of the matter. I mean, I probably written about wine for a number of years before I asked myself the question, why is red wine red, right? On the face of it, that seems like a simple question, but it's not a simple question. There's a big answer to that question. And so, I don't know, as someone who is self-taught, I really feel like every question about wine is a really good question because it probably has a pretty interesting, deep answer behind it.
Well, the way that you just responded to that is why you and I are here together today. What I do want my listeners to know is that the 12 years that I have been in the wine industry and the experiences that I've had, as I've told you, are very much thanks to you and the work that you do. So if you remember just a tiny bit about my background, I'm from New Jersey, but I was there through college. And then I was in Orlando in the hospitality world for Disney for many years. And in 2012, I was looking to make a change. And I remember sitting at the computer and Googling wine program, wine class, wine education. And that's where your wine immersion at the Culinary Institute came onto my computer. And that was a life-changing Google right there. And I'm going to try not to gush, but it really was a pivotal moment because I came out here to California for 2 months. And much of that program was with you in the classroom. And then some other weeks, we had some other wonderful instructors. But I just remember I was a wine lover and a wine drinker, which is where the passion was starting. But sitting in a classroom with you and hearing the way that you described things, right? And you've already said some of them in our short time together here about how wine is idiosyncratic. And I have notebooks of Karen quotes of wine. And now as a wine educator myself, I find these things coming out of my mouth. And when I sit and think about it, I think, wow, Karen really has shaped the way that I think about wine, the way that I teach other people about wine. As you probably know, I'm now making my own wine, which was part of the goal. So first and foremost, just a huge, gushy, grateful thank you
for doing what you do, because I would not be sitting here in Santa Rosa in Sonoma County today if it was not for your work. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to try not to cry now.
I'm a big old emotional feeler. So actually, I'm going to use that as a segue. So when I was pulling out my notes from a more recent training that you did for us at Pride Mountain Vineyards in 2022, one of the things that I've always loved about you, how you help us frame up wine, is thinking about the emotion of it. And I have this page in my notebook. I love to take notes. I'm a copious note taker. And hopefully this is pretty verbatim what was coming out of your mouth, but I think this could be a great, great sort of starter to our conversation here. So ask yourself about wine. Why should anyone drink it? How does it feel? If you could draw a picture of it, what would it look like? Does the wine evoke emotion? How do you remember it? We want the wine to be attached to a memory. So let's start there. You're so effective at helping us to think about wine in these ways, in the emotional ways, the metaphors, music, architecture, whatever it may be. You said the word self-taught a moment ago. Where did this come from? How did you develop this approach to wine? Because it's so effective for so many.
It came from being an outsider. When I started in New York, a long time ago in the late 70s and early 80s, there were very few women in the wine business. There were no wine schools in the entire United States. Kevin Zraley had just started Windows on the World. And so there was no way in. Most wine was written about by British authors, many of whom had gone to Oxford or Cambridge. They were very privileged. They had often grown up with parents who had cellars, and Oxford and Cambridge themselves had cellars. And, you know, I was a kid from nowhere without access. Nobody in my family ever drank wine. And so when you teach yourself, you know, the possibility exists that you teach yourself incorrectly, right? You might teach yourself the wrong way.
I've done that.
Yeah. I think I've done that too. But over time, the good part of it is, as a writer and someone who teaches and gives tasting seminars, you develop your own personal way of describing wine that if you are, in fact, a teacher and a writer, you are forced to express. You can't just sit there and have it in your head and think, okay, I know what I think, but I just can't tell anybody about it. You have to communicate it. And when you find your own way, you are immediately tested out, right? Because people either read your articles and like them or they don't. And when you look out over a sea of students, you can see in their eyes, either this is resonating or it isn't. So I guess, you know, it came from being an outsider and then seeing that some of the ways that I was thinking about wine and describing wine were also true for other people.
When you say, you know, looking out into the sea of students and seeing on their faces what resonates, I'm like, well, if Nikki Lamberti is one of your students, you're seeing tears and you're seeing goosebumps, because when I do have those aha moments and I remember them, they can be really touching and emotional. And I think when I started studying wine, and we had such a great class, there was a small group of us that were together in your program for a while, and we're still close to this day. But I was a little bit self-conscious because I was new in this wine world. I think I was an outsider, right? The girl from Disney is now sitting in a wine classroom. And I think I was self-conscious a little bit to try to be more studious and to hold back that emotion. You know, it was coming from a very magical place where I was literally selling magic at Walt Disney World. But I can't escape it. And wine is emotional and it gets me excited and it touches my soul. And it's why I, you know, made a complete life change to be here and to do this. So, if it's Nikki in your classroom, you're probably seeing teary eyes, and even 2 years ago, you know.
But you know, I so respect what you've just said, because I cannot tell you the number of people who have cried in my classes. And when you say that to someone who, let's say, doesn't drink wine, and they're like, "What? That makes no sense." But if you are a wine person, that makes total sense to you. You realize that wine is an emotional beverage. It does. Part of the reason that once you fall in love with wine, you almost never fall like out of it. I don't know any single person who has said, yeah, I'm done. I got it. You know, I'm moving on now. I went from bourbon to whiskey and whatever, and now I'm in tequila or something. Not to say anything bad about spirits, but wine has this really hard to describe emotional power. And everybody who feels it knows it. And it's why you stay connected your whole life.
Yeah. When I reached out to you a couple of weeks ago and asked you if you'd be so kind to spend a little bit of time with me today, you've been on my list of reach guests since I started this podcast. But what really was the catalyst for me to reach out and finally ask you to do it was something that you had shared in WineSpeed and some of your posts in your social media about when you posed the question to a group of winemakers recently and you asked them, why is wine important? And I actually sat down and recorded a 20-minute solo podcast episode with my thoughts on that. And it was really powerful. And in that podcast, I said, one day I'm going to have Karen here. And she's the one who posed that question. And she can give us her thoughts. So can you just share with our listeners where that question came from? And why do you think that wine is important?
Well, having been a wine journalist now for, amazingly enough, 40 years, I'm feeling a little old right now when I say that. But, you know, I'm the kind of note taker who writes everything down. I mean, in the early days, you didn't really have recorders and recorders. I wanted to actually be able to feel and touch my notes. So I'm like a stenographer. So for 40 years, I've written down so many things that winemakers have told me around the world, right? It was aged for, 20 months in 70% new oak. I write it all down. And over that time, I realized that, okay, these recipes for wine, what you did as the winemaker, are important, but they miss the essential element that compels all of us to be in love with wine. And the essential question really is, why does wine matter? Why is it different than anything else? And again, no slam on beer or spirits or anything else. A cold beer on a hot Saturday afternoon is fantastic.
Amen.
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. But it's also, wine is a different kind of experience. So why does wine matter has always been a really important question to me. And I started asking people that some number of years ago. So recently in the Napa Valley, at a very important event here, which you know of, called Premiere, I asked the organizers, could you give me a separate room? I need to have a quiet room in order to record this. And we chose 5 winemakers. Actually, the Napa Valley Vintners chose the winemakers. I didn't even choose them. And I told each of them, though, that I was going to sequentially ask them. They were not in the room at the same time. They came in one after the other, and they didn't know the question. I said, there's only one question. And I think a lot of them felt like maybe it would be like, what is your extraction method for Cabernet Sauvignon? The tannin isn't too extreme or something, right? Something like that, that they would have immediately answered without any problem. So what was so fascinating to me was the question is, why does wine matter? And I have to say, Nikki, what was astounding to me is that every single winemaker paused. They were like, oh. And I thought, I can't believe that you don't have an immediate answer to this, is what I was thinking. But admittedly, it wasn't the question they were expecting. And it is a big question. And it is a question worth like taking a pause and, holy God, yes, let me think about that. Why does wine matter? But it did make me think, you know, we don't ask. We even in the industry, and I'm sort of a side juncture to the industry as a journalist, but it made me think, wow, that question isn't asked maybe enough. Because if 5 prominent Napa Valley winemakers pause a little too long in a way, that's an interesting point to me. So why does wine matter? And what would I say? So it is a hard question. It's a sophisticated question. I think my own answer would be that, especially now in a world that is kind of digitized to madness, right? You can barely get out of your pajamas without checking your cell phone. Wine, in a way that is somewhat subliminal, attaches us to nature. And even when I lived in the middle of Manhattan, in the craziness of a highly concentrated city like that, wine was a reminder that you're taking nature straight into your body, that this is not a commodity that can be replicated. You can't distill 20,000 pounds more potatoes and make more vodka. You are tied to the rhythm of something very primal and, in a sense, very primordial. And even when you can't articulate it, and I can't always articulate it very well or any better than I'm saying right now, but I think it touches people. I think they feel like they're in that, and they are in that circle of life, of nature. It's certainly the unspoken motivation for so many winemakers who realize that they're now in this grand cycle of nature and life. And that's powerful. It's powerful and it's emotional.
I like to say, along the same lines, it speaks of a place, right? Like you said, it's nature into your body. I mean, especially a well-made wine that really is reflecting the place where it was grown and the people who grew it. It is a reflection of a place, and it's a way to experience different places in the center of Manhattan or New Jersey or Orlando, wherever you are, right? So we're tasting Sicily today. And when we were selecting a wine for today, I was hoping you were going to say, oh, I have just the wine. I've tasted something recently, or I've revisited something recently. And you said, nope, you pick. And I was like, oh, goodness, the pressure of picking the wine. So I went around and around. I had so many different things. But as I told you, I've just got Sicily on the brain because I'm going to be visiting for the first time next month. And I also know your love of sparkling wine. So it was kind of the mashup of the two with this. So why don't we just talk about this wine for a minute? We call this our Sip Spotlight.
Sip Spotlight.
Mirko is the producer. Are you familiar with this, or do you know much about them?
I was not. And so I'm glad that you chose, because like you, I'm a fan of Sicilian wine. And Sicily, in the last 20 years, the quality of Sicilian wine has just sort of skyrocketed. I mean, they're so good. It's funny because they're smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean there, but they remain somewhat unknown as a wine region. I'm envious that you're going there. I'm surprised by this wine because I'm surprised, but not surprised. I was going to say I'm surprised because it's so fresh and lively and juicy and very alive, which you associate in part with acidity, which this wine has a lot of really beautiful, crisp acidity. And you think of, wait a minute, it's going to be pretty hot in Sicily right there in the center of the Mediterranean. Really? Sicily is a volcanic island. Yeah. That's right. It's a mountain out of the sea. And so when you think about any Sicilian wine, one of the things you have to think about is its proximity not only to cold sea breezes, but also the altitude where the vines are growing. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't tasted this wine, so thank you for turning me on to it.
You're very welcome. I actually found this in our local Bottle Barn, you know, which is such a wonderful wine shop here in Santa Rosa. Their Italian wine section is really intense. But I've not enjoyed a lot of Sicilian wines, and I think this is probably the first sparkling Sicilian that I've had. So, of course, once I bought this wine home and getting prepped for today, I opened up my wine Bible, you know, the one that's has sold almost 1 million copies around the world. Do you know that one? Maybe, perhaps? Side note.
I know it.
My first exposure to the wine Bible was day one of class at the Culinary Institute. I didn't have the book prior to coming out here. Like I said, I was a wine drinker, but not studying. And my classmate sitting next to me was Ryan Bailey. Do you remember Ryan, who is now down in LA? Right. And he was already a Pali level 2, like a certified sommelier. Young guy, I mean, early 20s. And the wine Bible copy that he had sitting on the desk was so tattered. There was no cover. The highlighting and the dog ears on every page, it was like his whoopee. We called it like his security blanket. And I remember on the first day of class, you signed it for him. And he never was without this wine Bible in his hand. That was my first exposure. I said, I need to get this book and have her sign it for me. So that was my first exposure to the book. But I jumped into the Sicilian section just in preparation for today. And I just highlighted.
But I see you have the second edition. I just want to say you have to get the third edition, because the third edition, which came out last fall, has a much expanded section on Sicily.
Oh, good.
Because Sicily is, which is, you know, hitting the baseball out of the park. And this Merlot that you've turned me on to, sparkling wine, I just turned the bottle around to see who imports it. And it's imported by North Berkeley Wine Imports. And maybe I shouldn't do this in a way, but I've come to, because we taste in my office here in the Napa Valley in St. Helena, we taste a lot of wines. And I've come to know a little bit about what I think of as the palate, in a way, of various importers. And North Berkeley Imports has a lot of really good wines. So when I see that they're the importer, or Kermit Lynch or Skernick is the importer, I'm like, ooh, there's a good chance that this is going to be a really fascinating wine. I don't know anybody, by the way, at North Berkeley Imports. I don't know a single person there, but whoever is buying their wine has a real clear handle on delicious stuff.
What's also fantastic about this is it was $24 a bottle. That's pretty fantastic for some beautiful sparkling. $24, I was pleasantly surprised at that. You write in the Sicily of the second edition. Yes, so we'll get the third. Mount Etna's reds are not for the faint of heart. They're generally based on two grapes, Nerello Muscolese. Am I saying it right? Nerello Muscolese, which is what our Brut Rosé that we're tasting today is made from these grapes. And one thing I didn't know, and I was so excited to read, it is related to Sangiovese, which is a grape that I'm very passionate about. You know, that's what I make for my wine. So we're tasting an offspring, yes, in this Nerello Muscolese. What else do you know or like about this grape?
Yeah, I think one of the most amazing things about Italian winemaking in general is that if you think about grapes that we all know, like Cabernet Sauvignon, right? You can name all the places maybe in the world where that grape grows. Bordeaux, Napa Valley, Washington State, the Margaret River of Australia.
Italy.
Parts of northern Spain, parts of Italy, China, in fact, as well, right? And that's true for Pinot Noir, it's true for Merlot, it's true for a lot of grapes that we're all familiar with. Why is it that so many Italian varieties don't travel well? Nerello Muscolese is not grown almost any place else in the entire world. Neither is Nebbiolo, at least very successfully, or even Sangiovese. California in the 1990s had a sort of big affair with Sangiovese, and almost all of those grapes that were planted have now been pulled out and now replanted with another grape. So what is it about these Italian grapes that they don't travel well? That's the first question that I ask myself. And the answer, I don't know why it is viticulturally, almost every Italian grape has an incredibly strong personality in its place. So Nerello Muscolese in Sicily, you can say, tastes like this. But it's not really the taste of the variety. It's the taste of the place, because the variety doesn't have any transference. It doesn't really do anything very much any other place. And this is a variety. A lot of Italian varieties are both high in acid and bitter. Bitter sounds like it's going to be bad, but the Italians are remarkable at good bitters. If you think about radicchio, arugula, espresso, bitter chocolate, balsamico, even olive oil, right, has good thousands of good bitters in Italian cooking and in Italian wine. So for me, I'm always looking at, and I think this wine has this very, you know, explosive sense of freshness that is being underlain by all of its acidity. And then this slightly lemon peel bitter edge that is really interesting. And of course, the Italians cook with all of those bitters. You know, they'll shave a little lemon zest on top of a pasta. I mean, they would do things that we wouldn't think to do to add a complexity of flavor. So Italy is a world unto itself. And by the way, Italy is the chapter in the Wine Bible that I hate writing. I so hate writing the Italian chapter. I want to throw myself off the roof of the building. Just because, I mean, the
we
first Wine Bible.
We love reading it, so thank you. We love reading it.
Oh my God, the first Wine Bible, I left Italy to the end because I was so terrified to try to write about it. This was a big mistake. I was exhausted. The whole book had taken me 10 years to write. And now I had left one of the giant chapters to the end. So the second edition of the Wine Bible, I thought, all right, I'm getting Italy out of the way early on. And then I thought about three chapters in, I thought, okay, let me tackle Italy. I still wanted to throw myself off of the roof of the building because, you know, Italy, the irony about Italy, you know, if you're a researcher, you're looking for facts. How do things work? What are the facts? And I have a group of researchers who work with me. I always say to them, you know, don't tell me what Wikipedia says. Wikipedia is quoting us, right? Wikipedia is not a source. We do all of our own primary research, which means you have to go to the exact source. So with Italy, here's the irony. The exact source is called the Disciplinare. That's the governmental body of information that catalogs every law in Italian wine. The Disciplinare, it is so not disciplined. Italian wine, crazy. It is not disciplined. People
like how they drive in Naples, not disciplined.
Yeah, exactly that. So anything that you think you can deduce, you just go over the hill and somebody else will say, no, it doesn't work that way at all.
I remember the week we spent in wine immersion in Italy was exciting, but overwhelming because the number of Italian grapes, you know, before you even get into anything else, just the number of grapes alone. But it was also some of the most emotional and exciting wines for me in that week that we spent studying Italy, which is what led me to find the few acres of Sangiovese that are planted by Mr. Joe Ramazzotti in Dry Creek and convince him to sell me a ton because, A, there's
good
not a lot
you.
Of it. So, yeah, yeah.
Because there's not a lot left.
No.
That's great.
I keep asking him every year for more than a ton, but we've not got more than 1.1, but I'll take it. And it's fantastic. And they're, you know, 35-year-old vines and it's wonderful, but it's rare.
That is really good because age of Sangiovese really matters. So good for you.
Yeah, thank you. I can't wait to taste it. Yes, we're very honored to work with Ramazzotti as our grower. So while we're sipping on this wine, would you be open for some listener questions?
Listener questions.
Sure.
The first one is from Jennifer, who's actually in Santa Rosa, and she wants to know, who would you want to play you in a movie about your life?
I don't know.
Have you ever been asked this question before?
I have not, but I am writing a memoir, which is an interesting point, and I've been told that, I don't know, maybe this could be a Netflix series. Maybe everybody is told this, so I don't know. You know, all right. I just have to say, I don't know. Thank you, Jen. And Jen, I'm going
to
let you decide who should play me.
I think what comes to mind for me is obviously someone very classy, articulate, and kind. I think of like Annette Bening. She's just like, she's stunning and she's lovely and she's smart and she's warm. And I don't know. That was the first thing when I read that question. That was the first thing that came to mind for me. Is that your Barbie on your shelf looking at me over your shoulder?
Yes. This is wine Barbie. Here she is. But yes. So I have a wine Barbie that is modeled after me. And actually, I was wearing exactly these clothes. Wine Barbie is holding a glass of red wine. And so how this came about was a few years ago, I did a tasting seminar for the board of Mattel. And they came to the Napa Valley. I gave this, I hope, wonderful tasting for them. And then they all thought it was great. I left. That was that. And about 3 or 4 months later, I'd completely forgotten about this, of course. I mean, it was good. It was successful. And on we go. 3 or 4 months later comes this box from Mattel. And I'm thinking, Mattel, what could this be? And it was around Christmas time, I remember. So I'm thinking, did I order something from Mattel, for like a toy for Christmas? I open it up and here's the note from the CEO of Mattel saying, thank you so much for a fabulous tasting. And here's Wine Barbie. And they had taken a picture of me and they actually created
it. Looks like a Barbie doll. It's crazy. What is that like to look at yourself as a Barbie? I've never been able to ask someone that.
It is exactly, it looks exactly like me. It was so funny to me. So yes, Wine Barbie exists. There's only one in the world. And here she is.
Wow. Okay. This is from Catherine. Catherine would like to know, if you could only listen to one song while drinking one wine for the rest of your life, what is the song and what is the wine?
You know, at least the wine part, I'm often asked, like the equivalent of, you know, what's the desert island wine and things like that. But wine isn't that way. The whole idea of wine is to keep having these different expressions that touch you in different ways. It's not like many other things. You feel like you discover, oh, this is what I like. This is my color. This is my car, whatever. But wine isn't like that. There is no, this is my final one. I've sometimes said to students, the best way to learn nothing about wine is to continue to drink what you already know you like.
Amen.
Right? Because you already know. And wine is supposed to be taking you other places. You might have a kind of safety wine that you know you're going to always love, Sonoma Pinot Noir. And I love Sonoma Pinot Noir. And so that would be a good idea. If I ever just fell in love with one wine and that was it, then not only would my business be over, but my writing career would be over. And in a way, my love for wine would be over because it would imply a finality that I think is not really there.
I am not surprised by that answer. So thank you. That's along the lines of what I would have expected. So this is kind of a derivative of that question, but more importantly, it's not asking about one wine. It's asking about when you were a young writer and then you moved to New York and you were Today Show and USA Today and all these publications and shows and TV. I think you have an Emmy. I don't see an Emmy on the shelf behind you, but you have one, right?
Yeah.
Is it at home? Oh, it was right behind your head. I didn't see it. That's a Preston. Congratulations. Jason wanted to know early on, was there a wine or a type of wine that was the catalyst to move you into the wine world, especially being an outsider and a woman?
Definitely. It cost 89 cents, Bulgarian red. I was 15 years old and I drank a glass of this every night while I was doing my homework in high school. And I was just struck by how beautiful it was. I never actually walked all the way into a wine store because I was too terrified. But this would come from the sale bin at the end of the counter, all of which were 89-cent wines. And on the weekends as a really special treat, I would sometimes buy myself a bottle of $1.25 Liebfrahmilch. Was there a better wine in the entire world than Liebfrahmilch? I don't think so. I loved that wine. And then eventually graduated into Matus and Lancers rosés, the great rosés of sort of the late 1960s and early 1970s. I began very humbly with very humble wines.
Same here for me. I mean, that's where we start, right? So that leads to my question now, kind of directed to the listeners. As I mentioned, I have a lot of listeners who just enjoy wine and they're learning and they're exploring. So what is your advice to people who are maybe very new to drinking wine, or all that they know about it is that they like it and not much deeper than that? What is your advice for them?
It's important to have comfort. So if you like wine and you know you like it, and, you know, who wants to come home after a long day of work and then find that you're drinking something that you actually don't like? That's not good, right? To some extent, we want comfort wines just like we want comfort foods.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's hard to expand your knowledge if all you drink is the one wine you know you like.
Right, right.
So even as a young person in my late teens and early 20s, I would allot myself a kind of experimental budget. Mind you, this was like $6 a week. It wasn't big. I was definitely drinking from the bottom shelf in the grocery store. But I would buy something that I knew, like my Bulgarian red or Liebfrahmilch. And then every now and then I would take my $6 and buy, like every week or two, buy something else just to expand my horizons. And God knows, maybe I liked it even more. Maybe I couldn't make sense of it. Maybe it was terrible. But you have to, in some way, keep your horizons broad on wine, because the world of wine is so big now. There's so much interesting stuff out there. And you don't want to, I mean, I always make a comparison to food in this case. I mean, you would never, if someone said, okay, you can only eat chicken and carrots for the rest of your life, even if you love chicken and carrots, it would be unthinkable in food, right? You would be like, no, I'm not going to just eat chicken and carrots my whole life. But a lot of people drink very narrowly their whole lives. And so they're missing out on all the mangoes, all the, I don't know, all the salads, all the pork chops, all the other things in life. So if you eat broadly with food, and most people do, then your drinking should be similar.
Yeah. I just had a memory when you were talking about one of our homework assignments that you gave us during the wine immersion course. And you said at the end of the day, go out tonight and order a glass of something that you've never had before. And I remember it well. I went to Trevina, which was still open as the restaurant, which is now the Charter Oak. And I sat at the bar and I had a glass of Falanghina, and I had never had that Italian beautiful white grape before. And it was on my radar forevermore because of that homework assignment. And that was new to me in the first week of this class, right, where I was now being immersed in the world of wine. So thank you for that homework assignment. It's actually one of my favorites now.
Thank you for telling me that. Yeah. I mean, as homework assignments go, it's pretty good.
Pretty awesome.
Right?
It's pretty awesome. Okay. Final question. I was listening to another podcast that you recently did, and the host was asking you about your favorite food and wine pairings. And I know that you have a favorite pairing with champagne or sparkling wine, and it's maybe unexpected. Do you remember what you said or what that is? Is it tried and true for you?
Yeah, I probably said potato chips.
You sure did.
Yeah, you know, crunch and bubbles. Oof. I mean, what better textural combo could there be? There's a professor at Oxford who initiated a whole field of study called gastrophysics. In several of his experiments, actually, he showed that not only are textural matches like that fascinating, but that sound is a very big predictor of flavor. So he took Pringles potato chips, and it turns out in the experiment that the more sound a Pringles potato chip made, the higher it was rated as a great potato chip. And he was able to show this in other foods and other beverages. So with sparkling wine or champagne, the sound of those bubbles, not just the cork, but that beautiful whispery sound of pouring bubbles into a glass and then the crunch of the potato chips. So sparkling wine or champagne and potato chips are firing on all cylinders, not just flavor, but also texture and sound.
I love that. But I think about, you were talking about chicken and carrots before, and I'm like, carrots are loud. Carrots are crunchy. They don't give me as much joy as a potato chip because they don't have the salt, yes. Right? They don't have the salt.
Yes, the salt. The salt is important.
On Mirko's, the producer's website, they have suggestions of food and wine pairings with this particular Brut Rosé. And I was laughing at the Italians because it's so specific. Pigeon breast in red wine sauce.
Yeah, exactly.
Wild mushroom and eggplant phyllo parcels. And my favorite, spaghetti with sea urchin. So Italian.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
So again,
a famous chef came over and then they had a great dinner that everybody had a great time at. And then they wrote those down.
Yeah. They sound fantastic, but I'm going to go with potato chips. I agree with you. That would be fantastic. So before we say goodbye, I'm going to read your descriptor here for Wine Speed. So it's a new style of wine media for the modern era. Tell me a little bit about this project and why you think our listeners should be a part of this community.
Yes. So we began Wine Speed a few years ago, and it's a digital newsletter that comes to your inbox every Friday. It's really fascinating, fast. You can read it really quickly. There's a wine quiz. There are often food quizes.
I love the fascinating quizzes. Facts. I love the quizzes.
Yeah, I bet you do. Yeah. I bet you, Nikki, are like, I got to get this right.
Yes, a little bit. Okay, maybe a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. We, you know, hundreds of subscribers all over the United States. And people will write me saying, oh, I'm on like a 30-week, you know, roll. I've gotten every quiz right. It's pretty fascinating.
That's not me. No, I'm not on that roll.
I began Wine Speed because, of course, the Wine Bible is well known. It's big. It's a book. But I thought, wouldn't it be great to have like a weekly dose of wine education that wouldn't require you to work very hard? You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to open a book. It just came to you. But a dose of wine education that was fascinating and that had the same, in a sense, authority behind it that the Wine Bible has. Because when I started Wine Speed, there were lots of Instagram stories and blogs. And I thought, wait a minute, this isn't right. You know, they weren't fact checked. And I like to think of myself as a good writer, but I'm also a good researcher. I'm on top of my stuff and my facts. And I don't want to say anything that is like, not really true. So Wine Speed is fun, fast, fascinating. And underlying that is a researcher who wrote the Wine Bible. And it truly is fun. People get addicted to it. It is now by subscription.
Yeah.
And you could just go to winespeed.com and sign up. But in many ways, it's the most fun thing I've ever done. So I encourage all of your listeners to subscribe. We're happy to offer to your listeners a 20% discount on Wine Speed. We'll create a special code for you. We'll give you that code for any listener who would like to see what Wine Speed is all about.
That's so kind. Thank you. That's wonderful. I will definitely share that.
I just want to say that thank you for doing what you're doing. Wine is, it's a people business above all else. It's one person talking to another person, talking to another person. And having a podcast like yours, where you're very individually touching other people, is how the wine world works. So congratulations on your podcast and for deciding to do this, because I know you're the kind of woman who just decides, I am going to do this. So bravo. Brava to you.
Thank you. I decided, and then it took about 5 years to actually make it a reality. But as of today, we've just surpassed 3,000 downloads and listens, which, you know, if you're a celebrity with a podcast, that's nothing. But if you're starting from the ground up, I'm really proud of that. And so much of the confidence that I have to sit in front of this computer, pull up a mic, and teach people about wine is because of the foundation that you gave me. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Oh, that's very sweet. Thank you, my friend.
I'm still floored over the whole thing, but that I was able to share with Karen McNeil a wine that she hadn't experienced before. So I also have to give a shout out to Liz, who works at Bottle Barn, for helping me to find that wine and reassuring me that that would be a good one for Karen to taste. Thank you, Liz. That was everything I could hope for and more. Now, I had 3 more pages of questions, but I wanted to be respectful of Karen's time. So maybe one day there will be a sequel. Wanted to share with you a special listener discount code if you'd like to be a part of Karen's Wine Speed community, which I highly recommend. Like she said, it's every Friday, great emails, quizzes, discount codes for things wine related. When you subscribe at winespeed.com, just use the code SIPWITHNIKKI20 for 20% off your subscription. Thank you for that, Karen. I'll also put in the show notes links to the Wine Bible and also links to her beautiful wine glass collection at Macy's and Amazon. They are fantastic. What else can I say? I hope you enjoyed. And as always, I hope you sip well. Thanks for listening.